Good afternoon, brothers and sisters. Today our study is going to be on chapter 11 of Daniel. Chapter 11 gives us a portion of the book of truth given to Daniel by the angel of God in the previous chapter. The prophecy given to Daniel in chapter 11 gives amazing detail of the future events. There's so much information in this chapter that is a little confusing, so bear with me. The first part of the chapter depicts the downfall of Persia and then the establishment of Greece. The prophecy was given in the year 540 BC during the reign of Cyrus of Persia. Cyrus reigned jointly with Darius for 2 years and then Cyrus was sole ruler for the next year. God goes to show in the first verse that Darius was in his plan, and he confirmed him and his strength and strengthened him. Then the angel said, "And now I will show you the truth." In verse 2, three kings, Ahasuerus, Smerdis, and Darius, would take over Persia after the fall of Cyrus. Under the rule of Darius, the Persian Empire would grow to become larger than any other empire. To keep peace and help the development of his empire, Darius had to conquer the Greeks. The battle was a massacre, killing thousands of Persians. Darius died before he could attack again. Xerxes, his son, had to take command and attack the Greeks in 480 BC. The verse continues, "And the fourth shall be far richer." Xerxes was well known for his riches, which gave him the power to extend his exploration and attack the Greeks. This was the start of the war that lasted for the rest of the Persian monarchs. Verse 3, we are introduced to a mighty king that would stand up, which would be Alexander the Great of Greece. He was the Greek ruler that conquered the Persian Empire and made Greece the ruling empire. He is considered the greatest commander of war of all time. His techniques are studied still today. Alexander ruled from 336 to 323 BC. He died at the early age of 33. His kingdom shall be broken up, and not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion which he ruled. Alexander the Great was killed before his son was born, so his kingdom was split between his four generals. Ptolemy Soter would be the king of Egypt, or king of the south. Seleucus became the king of Syria, or the north. Lysimachus and Cassander would divide the rest. War was common between the king of the north and king of the south, until they joined themselves together. For the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make agreement, in verse 6. Bernice, the daughter of king of the south, was given to the king of the north for marriage. When the king of the south died, the king of the north, that was Anicus Theos, put his treaty wife away and returned to his previous wife. Which this was a bad idea because the first wife poisoned him and killed Bernice and her Egyptian attendants to secure the throne for her son. Verse 7 says, "But out of a branch of her roots shall one stand up in his estate." Bernice's brother, Ptolemy Eurygrites, avenged her death in invading the kingdom of the north in BC 245. Ptolemy then conquers most of Asia, bringing back thousands of talents of silver, precious vessels, and images of Egyptian gods. So the king of the south shall come into this kingdom and shall return to his own land. In verse 10 says, "But his son shall be stirred up and shall assemble a multitude of great forces." Serenus and Anicus, the sons of the poisoned king, assembled a large army and attacked the king of the south. With several victories in battle against the south, Anicus took some of Syria. But then Anicus, king of the north, was defeated. A peace treaty was set up between the north and the south, which gave the king of the north time to build his army back. After a victory, Ptolemy, king of Egypt, went to Jerusalem and was prevented to enter the inner sanctuary. Due to this event, Ptolemy later slayed 40,000 to 60,000 Jews that resided in Alexandria. Verse 13, Anicus, king of the north, shall return to take back Syria after 19 years of rebuilding. The king of the south died and was succeeded by his infant son, Ptolemy Epiphanes. In this time of weakness, the king of the north and his son, or his own people, would plot to destroy him. But to his defense, the Romans would intervene. The king of the north then took Palestine and captured Jerusalem. In verse 17, the king of the north gives his daughter Cleopatra as a treaty gift to Ptolemy Epiphanes, for him to be a neutral between the king of the north and the Romans. Anicus, king of the north, was finally defeated by the Romans and driven out of Asia. While returning to his own land, he tried to steal from the temple of Elymas to pay the Romans' taxes and was killed. His son, Seleucus Philopater, took over his reign and raised taxes to pay the Romans. Philopater was poisoned by his minister Heliodorus, who is described as a vile person in verse 21. His assassin did not keep the throne very long before Anicus Epiphanes, a brother of the deceased king, took the kingdom with flattery and bribery. Battles for the land continued between the north and the south, when finally treaty was made, but deceitfully. Anicus, king of the north, took the most fertile portions of Egypt away from the Egyptians. From these lands he gave his soldiers the praise and spoil and the riches. The two kingdoms gathered their armies for war against each other. With Anicus pushing at Alexandria, the Alexandrians changed their king from Ptolemy Philometor to Eurygrates II, the brother of the old king. Egypt was beaten by the king of the north, and a peace treaty was arranged with lies between the kings. In verse 28, the king of the north will come again to Egypt to put Philometor back on the throne in Egypt. When Anicus left, the two kings, the ex-kings actually, of Egypt, decided to reign jointly over the empire. When Anicus heard of the plan, he decided to take the country. But with the help of the Roman Empire, he was stopped in verse 30. Then in his retreat, he ransacked Jerusalem, placing Greek idols on the altar and making Jews go against the covenant by eating unclean beasts and offering sacrifices to idols. Some of the Jews did wickedly against the covenant, but the people that knew their God shall be strong and prevail. The Maccabees were one of such groups that held strong the conviction. The Maccabean family rallied the Jews with few successes. Finally, under Simon Maccabee, the Jews were able to be self-governed until the city was taken control of by the Romans. In verse 36, the Roman Empire was shown to have the power to do according to his will and exalt himself greater than any god. The Romans conquered the Macedonian Empire, Spain, Carthage, and Sicily. Verse 37, he will show no respect for the gods of his ancestors worshipped. Constantine decreed that Christianity would be the new state religion, changing from the pagan religion of his fathers, starting the Roman Catholic Church. Verse 40 starts another section of the chapter. In the previous chapters, the king of the south and the king of the north were in our past. Now this king of the south and the king of the north relate to the future until the time of the end. These verses set up the events that will happen in our future. The king of the north will be Russia, will take Turkey. They will be like a whirlwind and shall enter and overflow. Russia will then enter into the promised land, going down the coastal route of Israel to Egypt. Russia will conquer Egypt and have power over their precious things. News from the east and out of the north shall trouble the king of the north. This possibly is the news of Christ and his saints. The king of the north goes forth with great fury to destroy and completely do away with many. He will pitch his tents between the seas of the Mediterranean and the Dead Sea, in the glorious mountains, or Mount Zion, preparing for war. The king of the north will have some victory over Jerusalem, and will seem supreme, but yet he shall come to his end. Christ and his immortal saints will intervene and destroy Russia, and none shall help him.
Thank you, Brother Todd, for those remarks. We'll now open this for discussion. Daniel chapter 11. Brother Sid.
Thanks, Brother Todd, for that rundown. That was a lot of running. An awful lot of history went down there. And like he said at his opening, it's always amazing the amount of detail that comes out of it. When you just read it and don't match it up with history, it looks like a bunch of meaningless garble. And when you put history alongside of it, almost every word in every verse has a place in a very vivid description of what happened. And the first thing that comes to mind is, you know, that these days there's an awful lot of people who try to claim that the scriptures were written by mankind. It's got some good stories in there that can help you to be a better person, but they deny the divine inspiration of scripture, that the Bible was a collection of stories. Now, I would really like to have them describe to me how a book that was written simply for entertainment or history could possibly be written like this chapter. It doesn't have any entertainment value because it's confusing without being compared to history, and it doesn't have any history value because you have to have history knowledge or information independent of it in order for it to make any sense. And so it is with many areas of the Bible. But it is certainly also sets the stage for the days when Christ came, and we look at, you know, all of the things that made the Jews afraid of Christ for, this man is not Caesar's friend. He's when you think about it, for the common people of Israel, who were simply following the leaders who knew better, to have anybody come and rock the boat at this time in history was something that would have made them terrified, because their land had been the tramping grounds from north to south and south to north, and the battleground had raged back and forth through their land until the place was an absolute wreck. And why would you want somebody to come in there and claim they were the king of Israel when everything was not great, but it was sure better than being the eye of the storm?
Brother Philip.
Along with Brother Sid, I'd like to add my thanks to Brother Todd. I've looked at this chapter several times, and I've always found it extremely difficult to get a good historical grasp on it in such a succinct way as being delivered to us by Brother Todd this afternoon. And I think that was really, really interesting. I was thinking too about what Brother Sid said, you know, how can men deny the scriptures? And in actual fact, because this is such a detailed exposition of the history of the times, as Brother Todd has shown us here, after the demise, in particular, of the of Alexander the Great, the critic has said that these details were written after the event. As always, the critics have to fall on their own sword, and there are several ways in which that can be disproved. I think, from memory, you know, even the writing of the Septuagint was done at such a particular time that this was before these events. But anyway, we don't need to trouble ourselves too much about that. We stand back in amazement as to the details that have been presented to us. A comment that came to my mind this morning, actually, when Brother Joel was speaking upon the chapter, and it was in the verse in chapter 10, verse 1, it says, "In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, the thing was revealed." It's an interesting, it's almost paradoxical in some ways, when we look through the book of Daniel and we see the various signs and symbols, and we've had a fair digest through the week, and it's enough to give us mental indigestion when we try to grapple with the signs and the symbols, the beasts and the horns and the heads and so on and so forth. And yet, if we take a concordance out as a simple exercise and have a look at the words make known, understand, shall show, it's quite common in the book of Daniel. You know, these things are written to for us to understand, and we've had plenty of exhortations on this in the week, for us to know these things, to be exercised by them. We were thinking of the verse in Amos where it says, surely Adonai Yahweh will do nothing, but he revealeth his secret unto his servants, the prophets. Adonai Yahweh will do nothing, but he will reveal his secrets to his servants, the prophets. We are a highly privileged people to think that the creator of the universe, who is ruling in the kingdom of men, has actually revealed these things unto us. It also reminds us of the words in the Proverbs, it's the glory of God to conceal a thing, but the honour of kings is to search out a matter. So it's our honour to do, just as Brother Todd has been doing this afternoon, in searching out these things and getting understanding. The 11th chapter covers such a large period of time, and as Brother Seth said, you know, we get kind of excited when we hear about the King of the North and the King of the South, because, you know, we know we brought right up to our own days. And one interesting point in the 11th chapter from verse 36 onwards is that really we get we've considered earlier on in the week the fourth beast with the 10 horns and the little horn emerging, which plucked up three of them by the roots, that papal horn. We considered that little papal horn speaking great things against the deity. And we considered the little horn that arose from the northern horn of the goat, of the four that came up after the notable horn was broken. And really, in this chapter, we kind of get the detail outworked. This is so often it's almost, to me, I sometimes think, the DNA of Scripture, that you're given a prophetic revelation, and a few chapters later, you're given a bit more details on it. You may go back into the past a little bit, but then, you know, the panorama of God's plan and purpose is then laid out again in front of us. And in this particular, from verse 36, 37, we have the king that shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself. As Brother Todd said, this was the pagan Roman Empire that emerged. But we quickly find that when we get to verse 37, then he shall regard, neither shall he regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any God, for he shall magnify himself above all. And some considerations of these thoughts lead us to realize this is not just pagan Rome. This is now becoming the papal system. This is the Western Little Horn, which has developed from the Eastern Little Horn, or that little horn that we saw on the fourth beast. He shall not desire women. This reminds us of Paul's words in 1 Timothy 4, I think it was, you know, marrying, abstaining from meats, neither given in marriage. I can't remember to quote that exactly. You know the verse I'm referring to. It was characteristic of the celibate priesthood of Catholicism being prophesied way back here. And to come back to think about what Brother Sid said, you know, far from the Bible critics being right, we have great reason to rejoice in the glorious revelation of the truth that the deity has given to us, his servants, and to see these details unwind in meticulous details sometimes. There were broad outlines during the course of the week we've been looking at, but here in meticulous details as it worked out from the days of the Persians, the Grecians, the Romans, right up to the present day when we are waiting for the time when the King of the South shall push at him and the King of the North shall come against him like a whirlwind. We're on the eve of the greatest event of all time, the apocalypse of Yeshua the Messiah, and we're holding fast to that, hopefully, so that we can be found acceptable when he returns.
Brother Jim.
Brother and sisters, as has been pointed out, the details of this chapter historically is something that it's amazing. It's not just vague, you know, four different metals or something like that. There is verse after verse after verse after verse of details that fits exactly with history. And what is the critic to do? The thing that they have done is the only thing they could do, and that is say, that chapter was written after the fact. This is probably a second or third century writer. because there's no way it could have been written beforehand. And so even the critics admit the fact that this is a detailed description that did come to pass, and there's no way around it. When you get in at Brother Todd, I'm glad he did it, not me, because it's the details of these histories. You're talking hundreds of years of history, and it's very interesting to go into it in its detail. It's exciting because you say, wow, look at that. It did happen that way. And like you say, the only way they get around it is say, well, this couldn't have been, so therefore it's not. Which is, you know, it's invalid. There's no reasoning for it. It's just that can't be, therefore it's not. The detail that is given, we've seen come to pass up until, I forget what verse it is, but towards the end, it's talking about things that will be in our future. The king of the north will come down. The king of the south will be in Edom, Moab, Ammon. These things have not happened yet. And yet, Brother Jim Phillips, a couple of years ago, I think it was here at Texas, gave a talk on the signs of the times. And he showed how that the Arabs, we think of the Arabs as opposed to Israel, and yet he called our attention to the fact that look at the Muslim world. I should use the word Muslim rather than Arab. Look at the Muslim world. Egypt has made a treaty with Israel. Saudi Arabia has made a treaty. Jordan. So these nations in the south, which Daniel predicted would be standing in opposition to the king of the north, we see them in the last decade, one by one, signing a treaty with Israel and with the West. But what do we see of Syria and Iran and some of these northern Muslim nations? They are just as hostile, as a matter of fact, more hostile than they've ever been. That, brothers and sisters, is not coincidence. That is, we saw Brother Todd ran through a lot of the fulfillment of prophecy. What we're seeing in those last few verses is what is happening in our day. And we can witness it and say, yes, he did know what he was talking about. This is not cunningly devised fables. There is a God in heaven that revealeth secrets and maketh known to us what shall happen in the latter days.
Brother Matthew?
Just wanted to make some comments further to what the brothers have been making. At the same time, offering thanks to Brother Todd for what was a very succinct address on quite a long and detailed period of history as we got here. The critics have made quite strenuous efforts to try and discredit the Book of Daniel. And I have a book at home which I haven't read, but it's called Daniel in the Critic's Den, which I think is a pretty neat title, considering all the efforts that have been made by them to get out, to find some exit out of the compelling truth that Daniel is indeed an inspired record. What they've done is made out that even though the Septuagint was translated before the events of this time, they've tried to make out that what happened was that they only translated part of the Septuagint, and the mental gymnastics take more than it does to just simply accept that what we have here is indeed the inspired word of God. And one of the other counter-argument to that, if ever we are faced with such a critic, is that, as we know, the prophecy is not fulfilled completely. And it's remarkable what has been prophesied concerning the King of the North in the latter days. We know that it's still future to us at the present, but the situation of things as we see them unfolding is really quite extraordinary. I'm looking in particular verse 37, or this king, we know, the autocrat, who rules according to his will, is going to do honour to a God of guardians, as it's also translated in verse 38. Brother Thomas translates it as a God of guardians. So this king, this autocrat, this king of the north, is going to give deference to a system which is unlike that which is the system of religion followed by his fathers. He's not going to regard the desire of women, and he's going to give regard to this God of guardians. And the fulfillment of this has to do with the Russian autocracy in that little horn phase, which we're discussing in chapter 8, as Brother Phil brought out. That little horn, which is very much Romish in its religion. And so what we see in those verses are some features which are absolutely characteristic of the papacy of the latter days. You know, the not giving desire to women is explanatory in itself. It doesn't really need any further details to give explanation and exegesis on it. But we know we can think of what Timothy said, what Paul said to Timothy, rather, when he said that there would arise an apostasy and that they would command to abstain from meats and from marriage, commanding to abstain from marriage. And that has been fulfilled in the Catholic system. The God of guardians is referring to the system of saints. I've got a note in my margin here. This was from a person called Chrysostom, and he says, "The bodies of those saints fortify the city more effectively for us than impregnable walls of adamant." So he was just about calling those gods, gods of forces, as we have it in the King James. And that's just one example from a whole catalogue we could look at of blasphemies emanating from that fourth beast in its papal phase. And so we get into the latter parts of the chapter, and it's very interesting for us to see some of the goings-on in politics, which might not lead directly to the unfolding of these final details in this chapter, but they give us a sense of the disposition, the leanings, the tendencies, and the empathies and affections of the foes in this drama. And you know, fairly consistently we've seen anti-Semitism in Russia. You know, the pogroms preceded Germany. We associate anti-Semitism with Germany, but the pogroms in Russia came before that. And cruelty has always been shown in the Russian psyche towards the Jews. And right up to the present, we've seen the Russians trying to send in armoured vehicles into the Gaza Strip. And all these things are fairly interesting to us, because we have the character here of this King of the North. It's a king which rules according to his will. He's a king which comes with great fury. He comes to utterly destroy and to take away many. This is the character, this merciless, tyrannical, autocratic mentality of this King of the North, which is soon to be manifested. So we've got all the features here, and we just need to watch out for them.
Brother Philip.
I'd just like to add a few more thoughts in and around what we've been considering. It is really difficult to try and grasp hold of all of the prophetic outworkings and the concepts which are in these chapters. One of the things that struck me when I was thinking here was one of the comments that Brother David Hughes made yesterday, drawing our attention to the exposition that Brother Thomas had in Elpis Israel. I don't think I can explain it as well as he did, but I'll have a shot now. Brother Thomas was making reference to the little horn that came out of one of the Grecian horns. So just to remember, on the horns of the goat, there was the notable horn, which was Alexander the Great. That was broken off when he was at the zenith of his power, and four horns came up in its place, and out of one of the horns, the northern horn, came another little horn. And Brother Thomas, to try and help the illustration, said if you can imagine having a fret saw and cutting a sort of a little circle out and placing it on a spring, I think Brother David reminded us, that you know, you could have this little spring, this little horn popping out from this northern horn, one of the four. So you've got this little horn popping out, this little tiny horn, tiny maybe in our minds, but it exercised it on almighty power in a sense in the Holy Land, because that little horn was the might of Imperial Rome. But we still have the four horns there, and we have the northern horn and the southern horn in particular. And this particular chapter, as Brother Todd has indicated to us, really doesn't take into any account the other two horns. It's basically concerned with north and south. And it really struck me, we were discussing during the course of the week, you know, after the Second World War was really an axis that went like east-west. You know, there were Britain and the forces of America and so on in the West. They were called the West, and there was the Eastern aspect. But nowadays, when we got all the American and the British troops down, you know, in Saudi and all this sort of thing, it's become a north-south situation. Daniel's prophecy has actually manifested itself in a north-south relationship. But coming back to that little horn power, I was trying to look through the 11th chapter then to see the last reference to the king of the north and the king of the south. Because in a certain sense, the king of the north and south disappears from history for a period of time. And I'm really scratching my head just to think about what that period of time was. Maybe it started the north-south aspect. I mean, the wars between the north and the south with the Holy Land in the middle may have stopped perhaps, you know, not too much after the Maccabean period that Brother Todd has drawn our attention to. But it's that little horn power that becomes manifest in the later verses as the Imperial Rome, as it developed in its power and as it went through. And I think Brother Thomas makes reference to whichever power held sway in Constantinople or modern-day Istanbul was that little horn power, whether it was pagan Roman, whether it was Roman Catholic or Greek Orthodox or Ottoman, it was the little horn power. But in this chapter from verse 40, the king of the south comes down upon, you know, having been antagonized by the southern powers, it comes down, and that little horn spring, which has been prevalent for such a long period of time, is now submerged again, and the king of the north, as the northern horn, actually becomes manifest again. I hope I've explained that situation, but it really is an interesting concept to consider the panorama of history as it will be manifested in the time of the end. When the king of the north comes down, that little horn power will be submerged, because the last phase, if you like, of the little horn in the east will be Russian. Russia will take Constantinople, we believe. It will take Turkey before its final push onto the Holy Land, as described here in the closing verses of chapter 11, and it will sort of suppress that little horn back to its level, and Russia becomes that king of the north, or that northern horn power, as it seeks to establish itself then in the Holy Land.